serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, continuing now with Stu Headley, 95 years old, but his memories of the attack on Pearl Harbor so crystal clear. He was on the USS West Virginia on December 7th, 1941, and it's already clear we're going to have him back next week so he can share everything that happened to him that day. But we left off a year before that, in late 1940, when his Atlantic-bound battleship received new orders for the Pacific and was then headed for Pearl Harbor.
I was excited because I wanted to go out to Pearl anyhow. So we got out there on January the 8th. The chief got us all together in the 3rd Division. I had a new name, which was Ham. From the time that I came down from the pilot house, they would want me to fall into quarters to assign me to a division. And they assigned me to the 3rd Division. Ensign Harris, sharp man right out of the academy, said to each one of us, he assigned us our battle station. And my battle station, Headley, you're going to be a gun pointer on main battery. That's the 16-inch cannons that you see. But we'll train you, because we know that you're just new aboard. And Crosland, you're going to be the trainer. You're going to train the ship out. And then he selected Kansen Beck, who was a first-class boatswain mate, gun captain, and he was the gun boss. So we have two 16-inch guns to a turret with a 4-inch steel partition between them. Well, when we got to Pearl, the chief told us, we're going to spend more time at sea than we are in port. And he says, let me explain that to you. Admiral Yarnell and Admiral Richardson established a policy that there's to be only one battle fleet in Pearl at a time. There's three battle fleets out here. Two will be out in training and exercising. We adhered to that till Thursday before the attack. Thursday, all 9 battleships were in port. However, the Pennsylvania was in dry dock.
Right.
The Utah, which was a converted battleship, was tied up over on the western side of the island where the Enterprise was supposed to be on Saturday. But because they ran into a storm, they had to fuel 4 destroyers. They were a day late.
Good thing.
Yep. No carriers were in port.
And let me ask you about that, Stu. I don't want to ruin your momentum here. You tell your story so well. But when you say that you guys adhered to that, I mean, this is almost a full year where every time you're going out, they keep this pattern, only one fleet in harbor at a time.
Yep.
Until 3 days before December 7th. What do you make of that? Do you read something into that or no?
Sure. I didn't understand it, but I met Commander Fushida, who led the attack on Pearl, and he's the one that clued me in. The first words out of his mouth, I was interviewing him for radio, KECR. Bill Clark was the station manager.
About what year was this?
72.
I knew you'd know.
Yeah. Because I met him that year at Hoover High School. I was with Youth for Christ. And Dr. Gene French, who was the director, I was one of his counselors for the boys. He said, Stu, I got somebody I want you to meet. I says, who's that? I'm not going to tell you. I'll take you backstage and introduce you to him. So he took me backstage. He said, I want you to meet the man that led the attack on Pearl Harbor. I says, Commander Fushida. He says, what ship were you on? I says, the USS West Virginia. Why do you ask? I was out to kill you. I says, you almost did it. But here he had converted from Buddhist to Christianity. So he came down. Before I got to say a word, he said, Stuart, if your country doesn't learn from its mistakes, it's going to repeat them. I said, explain that to me. Genda, myself, Admiral Yamamoto, and Tojo, all trained in Harvard University in the 1930s. Admiral Yamamoto was a naval attaché. We had access to all of your naval armament. That's how I knew that your battleships had armor belts, the thickness of the size guns that your ship carried. That's why I had to redesign the torpedoes for shallow water and for that. And I thought to myself, you know, we don't learn. And as we found out, all five of those pilots that crashed in New York trained right here at Miramar. So as we were discussing, he brought out the fact, Stuart, I got something else I want to share with you. What's that? On November 26th, we left the Kuril Islands with six aircraft carriers, two battleships, two heavy cruisers, 13 destroyers, and five giant submarines, each carrying a midship sub, along with the oilers and the auxiliary ships with us. But what you don't know is that on that very day, taking in consideration the international dateline, orders came out of your White House to Admiral Kimmel and General Short, prepare for sabotage. That's why 187 airplanes were out on the field, lined up wingtip to wingtip. That's why all nine battleships were in port. But there were 96 ships in that harbor.
So what does that tell you?
Setting ducks.
What's your interpretation of all that information we shared with you?
I sat through the Pearl Harbor investigation in Washington, and Halsey, in his comments, we can't put the blame on any one person. He said, we're all to blame. Roosevelt wanted Congress to declare war. Congress wouldn't do it. He came to the people wouldn't do it. Admiral Theobald gave the best explanation there was. Roosevelt inherited this country in a deep, deep depression. Now, I don't think you're old enough, but what was the first thing that Roosevelt did when he took office?
The TVA? The New Deal? What?
Closed the banks. When the banks reopened, your money was insured for the first time. Then he started the WPA, the NRA, National Recovery Act. He started the TVA. He started the CCCs, the Housing Act, and there were a whole bunch of others, which his administration was known as the Alphabet.
All the acronyms, yeah.
What Theobald brought out was what the average person in America did not know was that Roosevelt, before he was ever governor of the state of New York, was undersecretary of the Navy. And he knew when Hitler started on the move. Now, I knew from my sophomore year because I had read the book Mein Kampf, and it was all laid out there, what his plans were to conquer the world. Mm-hmm. Well, we had ships being sunk right off New Jersey.
Yeah.
And he wanted to go to war with Germany because he knew that if he could get this country into war, the economy would explode because the aircraft industry would advance, building of tanks, building of trucks, building of guns, ships would put this country back on its economic feet. And he accomplished because this country was united about 9 days after Pearl Harbor, like it had not been for ages. The recruiting offices were just jammed with fellows that wanted to join, and the economy exploded. But I believe with all my heart, Roosevelt died on his conscience what happened to Pearl Harbor. And if you follow back, you'll realize he died of a seminal hemorrhage. That's where the brain explodes. But I also point out the clue to the attack on Pearl Harbor was in his fireside chats, because he would always say at the close of his broadcast, Eleanor hates war, fella hates war, that's my daughter, Scotty, and I hate war. I'll never put this country into war unless we are attacked first. That was the clue. And I have documentation in regards to diaries of Cordell Hull, Stimson, and in their diaries, as the Secretary of State, Secretary of War, and Secretary of the Navy, in every instance, we've got to make them make the first firing on the country. Now, let me ask you, who fired the first shot of World War II?
The ward?
I had the fellow's funeral about 8 years ago that fired that first shot. A fellow by the name of Don Morgan. What had happened was there were a series of errors. I would say the first error was about 6:30 in the morning when two soldiers on Opama Point with a brand new piece of equipment, the radar, picked up a large fleet of aircraft. And it was just about the time that they were going to get off watch. So they called for Shafter. And Kermit Tyler, who was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, was on duty. And they told him, we got a large fleet of aircraft approaching the Hawaiian Islands that we saw on our screen. Kermit told him, don't worry about it. We've got B-17s coming in from stateside.
One of those B-17 pilots lives just up the road from here. I've had him on this show.
Is that right?
Bob Thacker. Have you ever met him?
No.
You should.
Yeah.
You guys would hit it off.
So they were coming in for a landing. They didn't have any weapons with which to fight or anything. Several of them, when they landed at Hickam Field, were just literally cut right in half.
Yeah. So they had picked up the Japanese aircraft, but they passed it off as the American airplanes coming in from San Francisco.
Yeah. What the error was, they should have told them the direction they were coming from. The enemy was coming from the north. The B-17s were coming from the east. That might have delayed the situation. But then also at 6:30 was when the Hoga, which was a little tug, sighted a periscope in restricted waters. Well, they notified the Antares, and the Antares was on its way into Pearl. So they, in turn, notified the ward, and the ward went to GQ.
That's general and quarters, so then general they quarters. Were ready to fire on this submarine.
Yeah, and they fired their 4-inch at the submarine, and the first shot missed. The second shot went right through the conning tower.
Just so people are following, that's the answer to your trick question. You were trying to fool everybody. They assumed the first shot was fired by the Japanese, but the ward shooting at that Japanese sub was the first shot.
Yep.
They just didn't know what was going to come of it.
No.
Right.
So as it turned out, I was getting dressed.
I want to really hear your whole story of that day. But since we're talking about this big picture stuff, and you have such a good handle on it, this has been your life for the last 75 years. When you talk about Roosevelt's desire to get into war, and that he died with that on his conscience. Correct me if I'm wrong. Just listening to you talk, I get the sense that you think he was hoping there would be some kind of attack, but that perhaps he didn't know how great the loss of life would be.
That was the thing. When he found out 2,000 some odd sailors and Marines were killed, I think it hit him pretty hard. But yet, you look at it this way, being that I was in the service, all those battleships are dreadnoughts. The maximum speed would be 21 knots against an airplane traveling 300 and some odd. Now, I've heard many people say Pearl Harbor was a defeat. I don't agree with them. My opinion is it was an eye-opener because the minute Nimitz took command, he followed Admiral Yamamoto's procedure. He built the battle fleet around the aircraft carrier.
Big change in strategy.
Yes. And you see, the aircraft had come into its own. It was amazing because in talking to Fushida, he clued me in that instead of using conventional bombs, which would never penetrate five steel decks, to get to our handling rooms, he used armor-piercing shells and 15-inch armor-piercing shells. And in the torpedo deal, where we've got 35 and 40 feet of water in the harbor, he redesigned the torpedo by taking the elevator and the rudder off, which are steel, and put wooden ones on to give it buoyancy.
Yeah.
But then we've got a 16-inch armor belt from the after steering to the anchor windlass room, he's got to get through that. So he put a double warhead on the torpedo. In doing that, it stretched the torpedo out. So when they dropped him from the air, instead of going down 50 feet under the water, they went about 20, 25 feet underwater. When they were coming at us, we could see them coming through the water. My buddy, Johnny Anderson, he was in a motor launch coming alongside the gangway, when he saw one of those torpedoes, he pulled his boat up alongside the Eimer belt, jumped up on it, stuck his head and shoulders through a porthole. When that torpedo hit the side of our ship, the force of the water drove him right on through. He got up, ran topside, jumped over, and swam ashore. The Navy didn't know that. He was supposed to have been in turret 3 in the left gun. And if he had, he would have been burned beyond recognition, like 11 men were.
And that is the kind of fate that Stu Hedley came so close to suffering himself. We just don't have enough time left today to hear the whole story, so you're going to have to make sure to catch our next episode when this Pearl Harbor survivor explains what saved his life that Sunday morning, not to mention all the close calls that followed. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and videos of Stu and Stan Smith, the first voice you heard today and the man who wants to interview any World War II veterans in the San Diego area. Stan's number, again, is 858-485-5398. And if you do have the privilege of meeting him, ask Stan about his adventures drumming for stars like Tony Bennett, Nat King Cole, Mae West, and Sophie Tucker, among others. I'm really looking forward to sharing Stu Hedley's amazing Pearl Harbor story with you next time. For now, I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.